Now what's the word?
Democracy.
Yeah, what's the word?
Democracy.
Now what's the word?
Democracy.
Yeah, what's the word?
Democracy.
You need to know.
Democracy.
Make it grow.
Democracy.
The seeds you sow will spread democracy. You need to know.
Democracy.
Make it grow.
Democracy.
Don't let it go, democracy. Don't let it go, democracy. We are your
election connection.
We are your
election connection.
We are your
election connection.
Welcome, everybody, to Election Connection. I'm your host, Ruth Newman, and today I am here virtually with Sean Riley, who ran for the 8th District City Council, but lost in last week's election to Cassie Chambers Armstrong. Thank you so much for being on my show, Sean.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'd like to start maybe by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a native Louisvillian and grew up actually out in the Middletown area and moved to the Highlands during college, and then just, you know, loved it so much I stayed. My wife and I had a condo in the Upper Highlands right off Gardner Lane in 2008, and so I was on the Neighborhood Association Board up there in the Upper Highlands for a number of years until I think like 2015 when we moved, and then we moved here to Tyler Park, and so we've now made Tyler Park our home, and I am now the Tyler Park Neighborhood President. But before that, you know, I graduate of Trinity High School, graduate of the University of Louisville, you know, born and raised, kind of the typical Louisville story.
And you have a BA in political science from U of L. Is that why you become so much involved in community activities and community organizations?
I've always been, you know, very involved in community work, very involved in political campaigns, very involved with different activism, things like that. Very involved in the anti-war movement here in Louisville in like 2006, 2007, to where I ended up working with a campaign called Iraq Summer. The Iraq Summer campaign was a targeted campaign at Mitch McConnell. We had a group of activists here in Louisville and across Kentucky that we would go across the state, and anytime Mitch McConnell would do an event, we were there protesting him. And we culminated that Iraq Summer with a very large event at Bellarmine University, where we had close to 500 people at Bellarmine basically demanding for an end to the Iraq war. After that event, we then marched from Bellarmine University to Mitch McConnell's house. Probably a group of about 300 or so people ended up protesting in front of Mitch McConnell's house for the majority of that evening to kind of culminate the Iraq Summer campaign. Some of the activism that I've done and been involved with, I've also been involved with election campaign finance reform, you know, working with money in politics. It's my view that there's too much money in politics, and if we could reform the financial system, we could reform politics. And you can't root out corruption until you change that power dynamic with money in politics. And so one of the things that I did that I was, you know, really passionate about in my campaign is I took what's called the Keep It Local Pledge. And the Keep It Local Pledge was essentially I was committing to raise a minimum of 75% of my campaign funds from those who actually live here in District 8. And so 4 years ago, candidates running for this seat only raised about 20% of their funds from people who lived here. So there was an interesting dynamic of outside money picking who the next council person was 4 years ago. And that just didn't sit right with me. And so that's why I took the Keep It Local pledge. In the end, we ended up raising about 77% of our campaign funds from those, you know, living here in District 8. I was the only candidate to do that. I know that the other candidates, they did raise money from outside District 8. They did raise money from outside of Louisville. And there was, you know, significant money coming in from outside the state, New York and Washington, D.C., places like that. My thing was, is I thought that the people who live here should have the most say in who the next council person should be. So, you know, election finance reform is an important issue to me.
Well, that's interesting. If you've heard in some of my previous programs, I spend a lot of time on that issue because to me that is the root problem with our entire democracy right now.
If you look at the election results and the financial reports, we ended up raising a little over $20,000 for this race. Miss Armstrong, she ended up raising over $60,000. And, you know, if you look at the vote totals, it's almost a one-to-one ratio dollar to vote.
Right. And, you know, the big thing that I've been promoting, and I will shamelessly do it now also, is clean elections, which I don't know if you've heard of clean elections, but they are practiced in several counties, cities, and states across the country. And it's very formalized. It's all perfectly constitutional. You don't have to overturn Citizens United because you can run a clean elections campaign, and it's very structured and has very strict rules. But the good part of it is that you get on the ballot under a clean elections category so that everybody voting is aware that you did not take any money from outside interests, that you only took small dollar donations from your constituents, the people who live in your district.
That's almost exactly the model that I used. I wish we had a system in place for all candidates. I know a lot of times developers and corporate interest will, you know, obviously try and influence elections and try and, you know, influence who wins office. And money has a big influence.
Certainly,
and so I think that was, you know, pretty clear in this race as well.
Yeah. And I have in the past asked that question to city council members. I've asked Bill Hollander. I've asked Brandon Cohen. He's your outgoing council person.
Yes, he is.
I've asked David James, the president, and they've all said to me the same thing. First, they've all said, it's not an issue here in Louisville, but you are giving me
it's an issue.
And the other thing that they tell me is that their hands are tied by the state, that the state won't allow the city to come up with clean elections, as they've done in cities like Portland, Oregon, Albuquerque, New Mexico. They've done it. Seattle, Washington. But they apparently are unable to do it here because of the way that our constitution is set out.
Yeah, and I know other candidates running for Metro Council in other districts try to take a similar approach to what I did. But I think their main focus was not taking corporate money or not taking any developer money. So I know in District 4, there was a candidate, Ryan Fenwick. He rejected all corporate and developer money. And then same with Robert Bell in District 4. He rejected the corporate and developer money as well. But, you know, in addition to me trying to, you know, raise the majority of the money from people who actually live here in District 8, I also rejected all PAC money. As you know, said I would not take any contributions from any PACs or political organizations. So to me, I think, you know, I really like that clean elections model. Wish we could get it, because I think, you know, one of the things that prohibits, you know, regular folk and regular people from running for office is that money barrier, you know, where you have that corporate outside influence trying to buy elections for their preferred candidates. And so if we had something like that in place, normal people like me and you would have a better shot at success in these elections.
Yeah, and it would certainly educate the public so much more. They would understand the whole reasoning. You know, nowadays, when you ask people about political corruption, everybody is in agreement that we have corrupt politicians, that our system has been corrupted. But then when you ask them what the solution is, most people will tell you term limits. That's what most people turn to, is term limits, which is ridiculous. If they knew more about clean elections.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about the money.
One of the groups I worked for was the Political Action Campaign Fund, and their whole focus was, you know, money in politics. And again, their focus was on Mitch McConnell. And so I worked for that organization for some time, and Mitch McConnell is, you know, really one of the worst actors in terms of money in politics dynamic. And so, you know, Mitch and I have a long relationship with protesting, you know, him for the Iraq summer, and then, you know, working with the, you know, election finance reform. There's a lot of people that have been trying to get rid of Mitch for a very long time, and it's a very difficult task.
That's right. He's got so much financial backing behind him from big, huge outside interests. Yeah. Let me go on and ask you, because I read that you are a graduate of, is it the Neighborhood Institute?
Yes, well, Center for Neighborhoods, Neighborhood Institute.
Yeah. What is that?
So the Center for Neighborhoods, so it's a program here in Louisville. It's now a nonprofit, but it used to be part of Metro Government. And so now they run a 12-week neighborhood leadership training program. So the goal is to get people from, you know, neighborhoods all over the city, different neighborhood associations, or if you're just looking to start a neighborhood association, to get people together. And it's kind of like a neighborhood 101 boot camp, but it's really a lot more than that. It trains people on how to connect with local government, how to connect, you know, neighbors and people together, how to connect businesses. If you have a problem in your neighborhood, maybe the streets aren't paved, maybe the street lights aren't on, you know, whatever it may be, how can you take this knowledge and then affect the change that you're seeking? Like I said, maybe you live in a neighborhood where you don't have streetlights, or maybe all your streetlights are off, and you've always wondered, well, you know, how do we get streetlights for this neighborhood? So they kind of do some really grassroots programs like that on how to get people involved to form, you know, not only a neighborhood association, but make your neighborhood association stronger. And so I got involved with that through my work with Tyler Park. I'm just recently became the Tyler Park Neighborhood President, but I've been on the Tyler Park Neighborhood Board since 2015. And we've always supported the Center for Neighborhoods with, you know, financial donations and gifts from our neighborhood. But this, you know, this leadership program, I went through it last fall, and it was just a really, really great experience, really eye-opening in terms of how to organize people. So, you know, I've always been organizing people on a political level, whether it's organizing people against, you know, the Iraq War or against Mitch McConnell or other various other political campaigns that I've worked for. But this is, it's a different kind of organizing. When you're organizing a neighborhood, you're organizing people, not for a political purpose, but for just the purpose of making where you live a better place. Changing something, you know, on the ground is really what Center for Neighbors is all about. And so really, you know, I can't stress enough how cool this program is, and I would encourage all of your listeners to check it out. It's the Center for Neighborhoods. Again, it's a 12-week leadership course. They provide dinner for you. So that's a big plus. But so as I was going through this program last fall, it was right when Brandon Cohen decided not to run for re-election. And so a lot of my neighbors and people here in Tyler Park, and then other people I've interacted with on other neighborhood associations, were strongly encouraging me to run for Brandon's seat, because we'd really never had a real strong neighborhood person, you know, kind of in Metro Council. I mean, Tom Owen was probably the best. He was really good because he actually came to neighborhood meetings. Either him or Tara would come to all the association meetings. And really, that's where you hear what's going on in the neighborhood. We hear what the problems are. You hear where the success stories are. You hear, you know, the cool things that people are doing. But Brandon Cohen had a different model. He was not one for going to those neighborhood meetings like Tom was. And so my goal was, I wanted to kind of take Tom's model and supercharge it and really have a really strong neighborhood association model, you know, get the neighborhoods really, really engaged in what's going on with the district.
So this institute, this Center for Neighborhoods, is in operation now. Anybody listening,
yes,
could go on their website and could actually sign up. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Good.
I don't know what their plans are, you know, for in-person classes. I know they have two sessions per year. They have a spring class and then a fall class. You know, the spring class was obviously canceled due to COVID-19. I don't know what their fall class is, but they do a lot of cool projects outside of, you know, the Neighborhood Institute. One of the things that they do that I really like is they have what's called a Better Block program. And so their Better Block program is you take a block that's blighted, or a block in your neighborhood that needs, you know, some serious attention, or something that you're just like, you want to see change. And they'll take that block and for, you know, maybe one weekend or two or three weekends, they'll transform this area or block in your neighborhood into kind of what your dream block would be, or vision block. You know, all the things that you think are wrong with it, they'll work to make better. They'll bring in things like retail if you are living in an area that's a food desert. So they may bring in, you know, pop-up grocery store, that type of thing. But it's really, they do a lot of really cool work other than just the Leadership Institute.
I wonder if now with this pandemic, they have accommodated it by doing what we're doing, having virtual meetings and getting people to kind of envision how to improve their neighborhood with each other in virtual meetings, do you think?
I think they are doing some of that. I don't know what their plan is for their fall class, but I mean, I do know that they are doing virtual meetings and virtual events like we're all doing. They usually do a breakfast, you know, kind of a once a year fundraising breakfast that they did this year, and they had it virtual. So it's really cool. I would encourage everybody to check them out. Again, it's Center for Neighborhoods. Even if you don't attend one of their classes or programs, just they have a whole host of resources on their website that you can tap into as well.
Yeah, and it leads me to wonder, now that we are also in the middle of these protests with the police, whether the Center for Neighborhoods could be an actor or is an actor involved in all of that, because especially if you're talking about diverting money from the police, right, and putting it into, like you said, blighted neighborhoods in order to empower people and give them some resources.
Yeah, I'm sure they are, you know, working on that. A lot of their work is in the West End of Louisville, so I'm sure that they are, you know, working with, you know, the protest movement. I don't know, you know, how much or to what extent they are a nonprofit, so I don't know how much they're able to do with the protest, but I do know, you know, one of their goals is definitely to create more equitable situations for neighborhoods that need, you know, additional resources.
Yeah, and you were involved in a whole lot of neighborhood activities that I read about, tree planting, going along and documenting what's going on with different buildings along Bardstown Road.
Yeah. So one of the other things that came out of the Center for Neighborhoods is this group I started last September called BIG, and BIG is the Bardstown Road Improvement Group. And so I really took a lot of the principles and practices that I learned from the Center for Neighborhoods and implemented them into this group. And so at the end of last summer, there was a lot of issues going on with Bardstown Road. It had gotten definitely edgier, maybe sketchier. There was a lot more panhandling going on, a lot more petty crime going on, you know, a lot of vacant and abandoned buildings, a lot more vape shops. And so we got this group together. It started off with about 50 people and then ended up growing to, you know, well over 100 people. And we were meeting every 2 weeks, just specifically working on what can we do to improve Bardstown Road. And so a couple of things that came out of that, one of the first things we did was a survey of Bardstown Road. So we surveyed pretty much everything on Bardstown Road from Broadway to the Douglas Loop, documenting, you know, how many street trees there are there trash cans, are there benches, you know, tarp benches, that sort of thing, you know, street trees, lights, vacant property, what the different businesses are. And we found that about 10% of Bardstown Road was vacant at that time. We also found that there were 16 vape shops along Bardstown Road. And so, you know, I don't know what the right number of vape shops is, but I feel like 16 is definitely too many vape shops for one part of town. And then through that, we then came up with like kind of the area of Bardstown Road that needs the most improvement, you know, where we saw had the fewest number of street trees, you know, had the most vacant shops. The block was between Grinstead and Keith's Hardware. If anybody knows where I'm talking about, it's the block that includes the old Washerama laundromat. And this has just been kind of really one of the worst blocks on Bardstown Road for some time. And so our goal was to transform that block into our vision block for one weekend. And so we partnered with the Highlands Commerce Guild and their event, Bardstown Road Aglow, to transform, you know, that area for one weekend, you know, take everything that we wanted to put there and got it in there. So we turned that vacant Washerama into pop-up retail. We brought in, I want to say, 10 different local vendors, everyone from somebody who was making clothes and t-shirts and different sewing type projects to homemade hummus. So we had 10 different vendors that we kind of turned it into a holiday market for Bardstown Road Aglow. The other thing is, you know, that's really important to make a street or a neighborhood, you know, more inviting, more welcoming is street trees. And street trees do a whole host of really great things, from slowing down traffic to reducing the urban heat island to making it, you know, more comfortable as you walk. to reducing, you know, stormwater runoff. So street trees have many benefits. And so this area had a very small number of street trees. And so we identified, using the city's own guidelines, 25 locations for new street trees. And so we brought in live 10-foot tall spruce trees and put them in bourbon barrels in all the locations where the city said that we could have a street tree. And so this was really to highlight the lack of street trees, but also show people what's possible if we could encourage the city to make a modest investment in this one block. You know, the other thing that we wanted to do was, we've been hearing a lot about traffic on Barson Road, that traffic's too fast. There's, you know, 9 pedestrian vehicle crashes per year on Barson Road, which is very high. And so we also wanted to show people, you know, how can we slow down traffic? How can we make Barson Roads safer? And so street trees plays a factor in that, like I said, but one of the things is the city has a plan for Barson Road that has just been, you know, sitting on the shelf, hasn't been implemented. And we wanted to show the city that, you know, their plan that they have, we want them to implement it. And so one of the things that it calls for is some crosswalk improvements, but it also calls for getting rid of the crazy lane switch light system. And so on the weekends, the lane switch light system is not operating. And so it's kind of a perfect fit to show people what Barson Road could look like when we don't have the lane switch light system. But then we also make the crosswalk improvements. And so we built a new crosswalk at the corner of Barton and Lucia using this model called curb bump outs or curb extensions. And so what that is you take the sidewalk and you bring the sidewalk into the street one car lane, to where for a pedestrian, you are only crossing 2 lanes of traffic instead of crossing over 4 lanes of traffic. And so this would be at a crosswalk. You kind of bump the sidewalk out into the street, and so it narrows traffic at crosswalks. And we built this using, you know, really DIY method. We brought in a bunch of bales of hay and traffic cones, and, you know, worked with the state and the city for approval for this, because there was definitely a lot of hoops and regulations to jump through. But we got approval from the city and the state to test out these crosswalk improvements that's in their own plan. Uh-huh. And surprisingly, it works. You know, when you narrow the street at a crosswalk, I mean, drivers really slow down. Pedestrians can see a whole lot better around cars, and cars aren't speeding through. And the other thing is, you know, we actually had a chance to showcase this to the mayor. So we invited him to come check out our vision block. And so we wanted to show him not only the retail aspect of it and the street trees, but we wanted to show them that these crosswalk improvements and the safety plan for Barson Road actually works. So we got him there. You know, we don't have a commitment from him to make the investment just yet, but we're still working on that. And hopefully we can get that plan implemented. But at least he came and saw, you know, what it looked like in action. So we were pretty excited for that.
So was this a temporary thing that you did, or is this there permanently?
Oh, I wish it was permanent, but no, we only had approval from the state and from the city to do it for one weekend only.
Oh, one weekend. Okay.
Yeah. One weekend only. But, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that we did is, so that old Washerama, that is now slated to become a new boutique hotel. And so one of our hopes and our goals, you know, when we started this project, was to get new investment in that area. And so, I don't want to say because of what we did, there's going to be a new hotel, but I think it had a factor in some of the decision-making process of what, you know, is going in there. So the Washerama location is now slated to become, I think, a 40-room boutique hotel that will have kind of like a 21C type feel to it, is my understanding. And that just got approval from the Barson Road Overlay Committee this past May. So we're excited for that.
Just this past month.
Yeah, this past month. Yeah. So hopefully within the next year we'll have a new hotel there. And the really cool thing about that is it's going to bring, you know, new customers to all the different shops and restaurants along Barson Road, and that'll have, you know, I think it'll have a really positive impact on the area. And so we're excited for that new hotel coming in.
And I also had read that you played a role in opposing, and correct me if I'm wrong, Airbnbs, and you did not want more commercial hotels in residential neighborhoods, residential areas.
Correct. Yeah, correct. Yeah, so Barton Road is zoned C2, so it's a commercial zone. All the neighborhoods along Barton Road are zoned residential. And so most people know what an Airbnb is. It's a short-term rental. And the way it's Airbnb should operate is, I've got one two doors down from me. Our neighbors, they rent out their basement from time to time. And that's totally fine because if they live upstairs and they can kind of control who's coming in and out of their house. The problem comes in is when, you know, outside investors or developers purchase houses in the neighborhood for the sole purpose of running them as a mini hotel, you know, these Airbnbs. And we're really being kind of inundated with them, you know, especially, you know, here in Tyler Park. I know Deer Park is seeing a ton of them, Cherokee Triangle. But, you know, imagine moving into a neighborhood and then the house next door to you becomes, you know, essentially a hotel with rotating people every week. There's, you know, somebody new there. You don't know who they are. You've got a family. You've got a kids. And now you're living next to a commercial property.
Yeah.
And so one of the goals or and focus of my campaign was I really wanted to change the Airbnb regulations. They're really changing the fabric of the neighborhood. And, you know, my goal was to require all non-owner occupied Airbnbs to be in a commercial zone. And essentially what that would do is that would, you know, force the Airbnbs out of the neighborhoods, unless you were an owner occupied where, you know, like I said, like you're my neighbor who is renting out the basement, but they live upstairs. That's totally fine. That's, you know, that's a good use of the Airbnb. But again, it's these absentee landlords, these outside investors who are buying houses for the sole purpose of using them as an Airbnb. So, you know, it's harmful on many different levels. Not just the fact that it hurts the neighbors and hurts the neighborhood, but it really has an impact on affordable housing. So you're taking housing stock off the market that could be used, you know, for a single family or could be used for, you know, multifamily, and you're turning it into a hotel in the neighborhood. So one of the things I really wanted to do was get those Airbnbs out of the neighborhood, get them to a commercial zone. And so for here in the Highlands, you know, that would have a really positive impact because you would then put those hotel guests on Barzine Road as opposed to in the neighborhood. So for instance, you know, maybe the Impala's Aries Pizza wants to have an Airbnb above the restaurant. That's great that you've got that's a good use of that space. Have it, you know, have it be an Airbnb. And then you have, you know, a host of rotating guests that can come have pizza or can go across the street and, you know, check out the different shops like Edenside Gallery. So I'm sure they would appreciate that. But like I said, their Airbnbs are harmful on many levels. And I mean, I am concerned now that the status quo will just kind of remain the same and allow these Airbnbs to, you know, just kind of continue to take over the neighborhoods.
Yeah, I happen to be surprised that the city would not make a distinction between owner-occupied as opposed to absentee Airbnbs.
Yeah. Well, so they do have a distinction, and they have a Board of Zoning waiver that you can apply for, and they have a rule, and it's almost laughable to call it a rule. So they have a rule that says you can't have a non-owner occupied Airbnb within 600 feet of another non-owner occupied Airbnb. Now, on paper, that sounds like a great rule, and it may be a decent rule if it was enforced. The problem is over 80% of the time, the city gives a waiver. And so even when you're 600 feet from another property that's also a hotel, the city's just kind of handing these waivers out 80% of the time. Is neighborhood associations like Tyler Park and Deer Park, you know, we're having to fight, you know, tooth and nail to stop these Airbnbs, you know, that are 600 feet. We're having to go to these zoning meetings and say, look, this one's 600 feet from another one. Why aren't you guys enforcing this rule? And so it's kind of like the default position for the Board of Zoning is just to hand out these waivers like candy. It's very discouraging. So that's why, you know, I want to just kind of scrap that whole 600 foot rule and just say, look, if you're going to be a non-owner occupied, you've got to be in a commercial zone. You can't be in a neighborhood.
Makes sense to me.
That's what I thought too.
And you are listening to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, grassroots, all-volunteer community radio. And we are here today with Sean Riley, who recently ran and lost his bid for District 8 City Councilman. However, as you've been hearing, if you've been listening to this program, his community activism and long-standing efforts to include and empower stakeholders in local decision-making have won him kudos from many in his district. So let's get back to our conversation with Sean Riley. So what is this pandemic doing now to all of these good activities, all of these meetings? You know, even the hotel on Bardstown Road, I wonder whether that gets scrapped because we just don't know how long this pandemic.
Yeah, well, I mean, so, you know, it's definitely tough. My immediate concern with businesses along Bardstown Road and the pandemic is just trying to prevent people from going out of business, prevent people from closing, and really trying to find creative and innovative ways to support our existing, you know, businesses and figure out, like, okay, what can we do to help them survive? And so one of the proposals I had made before restaurants started to reopen, Bardstown Road, we have a lot of unique problems on Bardstown Road that other parts of the city, you know, really don't have. We have really cool and unique buildings, you know, but they're old. And old buildings are fine. You know, they're probably the most productive use is, you know, reusing an old building instead of building a new building. But we do have some space restrictions that other places don't have. And we have, you know, some parking restrictions as well. And so, for instance, you know, if you have a restaurant out on Hirschborn Lane, they've got a big sprawling parking lot that they can now convert that parking lot to outdoor seating. And there are many restaurants along Bardstown Road that don't have any parking other than what's in front of, you know, the restaurant. And so, you know, I'm thinking of places kind of like Luvino or Against the Grain Public House or, you know, Highland Morning, places like that. And there's, you know, a whole host of others that I could go down the list that just don't have any place to expand their outdoor seating. So, you know, at 30% capacity, these people are struggling to stay in business. So the proposal I had made to the city was, let's take that parking lane on Bardstown Road and let's let restaurants convert that parking lane to what's called parklets, outdoor seating. And many other cities already do this and do it successfully. You know, you make it safe, you get some barriers. You make it cool and unique. You know, you get some planter boxes, you get some trees and some greenery, but you make it a cool space. And, you know, in a parking spot, you know, you could fit probably 8 to 12 additional diners seats for that restaurant in a typical parking spot. And so if you can give a restaurant maybe, you know, 2 or 3 parking spots right in front of their business, they now have a chance to survive. They have a chance to reopen, increase their capacity, because at you know, 30%, 50%, many of these restaurants are still not even making money. And so, you know, I was in communication with the mayor's office and with advanced planning on this. The city does have a parklet plan that is, you know, in draft format on the shelf that they could implement. And I'm, you know, still encouraging them to implement that plan, because I think it's really important to, you know, give people every opportunity they have to succeed. You know, it's not the restaurant owner's fault that there was a global pandemic. The mayor and the governor asked them to close, and they had to close for good reason. But now that we're letting them reopen, we have to give them every tool available to succeed. And so, yeah, it's one thing I'm still working on is trying to get that through, get approval from the city, and make those parklet plans a reality.
Yeah, you know, what it suggests to me is how neat it would be if they could say, for example, one day a week, like on a Sunday, close the entire Bardstown Road, or just have one lane for a trolley that could deliver people to the restaurants, and the rest of the entire street would be outdoor seating.
Yeah. So we have that once a year called Cycluvia. So we do that once a year, and so maybe we could do it once a month. But yeah, once a year we do Cycluvia, and it's thousands and thousands of people turn out, you know, to walk Bardstown Road, and it completely free of cars, and it really is amazing, you know, how productive a place can be once you remove the cars. I mean, yeah. So you get rid of the car. Space is valuable, and cars take up a lot of space. and you know, and people can make better use of that space for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, what one thing that we've discovered during this pandemic is clean air.
Although right, yes, people, absolutely.
Now that people are using their cars again and going back to work, it's not so much the case. But yeah,
and people were walking a lot more. People, you know, during the pandemic, people were walking a ton. I think people were rediscovering their neighborhoods. People were walking, people were biking, which, you know, I think it was a very positive thing to come out of this. But yeah, it's hopefully it sticks and people will continue to walk and bike and see the benefits of not using their car all the time.
That's one good thing that has come out of this pandemic is it's showing us how we can change our habits. We don't necessarily
Absolutely.
Have to commute to work. We can work from home. And they closed down Cherokee Park, the
yes, yeah.
traffic.
The driving lanes, yeah.
The driving lane, and people are out there walking and enjoying nature.
Absolutely.
So maybe this could be the beginning of a permanent transition if we started thinking creatively, you know?
Absolutely, yes.
I also wanted to ask you about that organization called Strong Towns.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about, because you were a member of that or are a member of that
yeah.
as well?
Yeah, so I am a member of Strong Towns. And so, you know, Strong Towns, they, you know, are an organization dedicated to some of the things we've already been talking about, you know, looking for ways to make places more productive, looking at how a city builds and how a city taxes and how development in a city affects not only their tax base, but their expenses. And so, you know, one of the things that they talk a lot about is what is a productive acre of land worth? And so maybe you take an acre of land, let's just say, you know, on Bardstown Road, and you compare it to an acre, let's say the mall. And that acre on Bardstown Road is going to be, you know, somewhere between, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 times more productive for the city than an acre at Mall St. Matthews. And so looking to make places more productive, but then also, you know, kind of stop doing some of the bad decisions cities have been doing. You know, so when a city builds, you know, more roads, more infrastructure, more sewer, more water lines, more gas lines, you know, people often will think that's progress because, hey, look, we're building more. But in reality, what we're doing is we're adding more long-term liability to the city's balance sheet. And so, you know, if you're building a new neighborhood somewhere out in the far-flung areas of the county, you know, it's going to take a very, very long time or probably never for the city to recoup the cost to, you know, build that neighborhood with the roads. That's, again, a long-term maintenance obligation. And so really the kind of the focus of Strong Towns is to stop sprawl and then redirect those resources back into the urban core of cities. You know, focus on what we have, focus on maintaining our existing infrastructure, you know, instead of building that new neighborhood out in, you know, the far-flung area of the county and destroying a green space. Let's take that money and fix the sidewalks in the neighborhood or repair a street or repair a bridge that's in need of repair. And so it's really kind of a, you know, a different way. Strong Towns philosophy is kind of a different way of thinking about how we build cities, how we maintain cities. And they kind of call it the growth Ponzi scheme. And so what that is, you know, it's, they think a lot of cities will think, okay, we just have to keep growing, have to keep getting bigger and bigger to maintain, you know, what they have. And right now, Louisville, we have seen, you know, huge outflux of people from the urban core to these far flung areas. And so not only are we building more roads and infrastructure, now our fire department and our ambulance services, they have to cover a larger area. Because they're covering a larger area, that's obviously more expensive. You know, our transit authority, you know, TARC, our buses now have to travel to farther areas and more miles traveled to pick people up. And so that's an added expense for TARC. And so to redirect those resources back into the urban core not only saves a lot of money for the city, but it's a more productive use of resources. And so that one of the cities that has recognized they have a problem is Memphis, Tennessee. And Memphis had gotten so large, they kept annexing different parts around them, similar to what Louisville did with merger. But Memphis kept annexing these far-flung areas and making them part of Memphis proper. And so Memphis has now instituted a different model. They've actually de-annexed. So Memphis has, you know, these parts of the county that used to not be part of the city, they have given them back to the county, and they're no longer providing, you know, police and fire for these different areas because they just can't service an area that large. And so, you know, I think at some point Louisville really needs to look at instituting a growth boundary to say, look, whatever the line is, we're not building outside this line. It's just not happening. If you want to build a new development, if you want to build, you know, something, you have to do it inside of this area, or you have to redevelop a brownfield in an area that's not being used. The Strong Towns philosophy is really eye-opening once you get into it and think about, like, okay, well, why are cities doing these things? And, you know, kind of comes to the development of, you know, the Omni Hotel project. You know, cities are paying people to come and build projects like the Omni or like the Yum Center. And we may never pay off the Yum Center debt.
Yeah. Well, so the Strong Towns is a national organization. Is it, where is it headquartered?
I think they're actually in a place called Brainerd, if I'm not mistaken. And I think they're actually international.
Oh, wow. So they must have lots of models so people don't have to reinvent the wheel, so they can see what has worked for other cities and what doesn't work.
Oh, absolutely, work. Yeah. Yeah, and it's really kind of goes back to this development pattern that we have in America. And so if you look at the way we develop our cities and the way we develop areas, it's a very unique American thing of how we're building cities now. And, you know, you look back to other, you know, ancient cities, Rome, Paris, and how they build their cities and how they're productive. It's not hard to see what is productive and what is not productive. They call it, you know, spooky wisdom, but it's once you see it, you're like, oh, gosh, why are we doing this here in America? And it really comes kind of back to that automobile culture where, you know, you have maybe one whole part of your town is just a residential part. Okay, so then the other part of your town is the working part. So you drive and you commute from the residential area to the working area. And for, you know, throughout all of human history, that was not the case. It was you lived close to where you worked. You had maybe a bakery. Maybe the bakery was on the first floor of the street and the family lived upstairs. It's a very productive model. And then because of the automobile, we said, okay, well, your bakery is going to be across town and you're going to live, you know, on the other end of town. So you have to drive to your bakery every day. And so kind of getting back to that traditional development pattern of having where you live and where you work nearby. And, you know, they call it the 15-minute neighborhood. And so the idea is that your neighborhood you should be able to have everything you need within a 15-minute walk in order to, you know, sustain yourself and sustain your family. And that's a really cool, you know, concept. And I think at least there's definitely some parts of the Highlands that are that 15-minute neighborhood. I mean, Tyler Park for sure is one because, you know, I can walk to the grocery store in under 15 minutes. I can walk to pretty much any restaurant I want in under 15 minutes. I can walk to the bank. So I can take care of all my daily needs within a 15-minute walk of my house. And exactly. I think that concept and that pattern, we should encourage that and try and replicate it in as many areas as possible.
Absolutely. And that's part of the problem in more impoverished parts of the city is that people are not within walking distance of employment. They're not within walking distance of social services or school systems or groceries. Everything, they have to have a car. They have to have transportation.
Yes. Yep.
I'm just wondering also, when you talk about neighborhoods, and then you talk also about development going on throughout the city, how can the neighborhoods somehow be empowered to have more of an influence on the city government? Because it's the city government that makes all these decisions, right?
Yeah.
And the planning commission and the zoning and all of that.
Sure.
How is it that you can envision neighborhoods becoming more powerful and more interactive with government?
So it really starts with getting a strong neighborhood association together. So even if you start a neighborhood association with maybe just 10 people, it's getting that collective voice is the first step. Then once you become, you know, more established and you can get more people and you have more people involved. So for instance, you know, with Tyler Park, we have about 350 dues paying members of our association. And so we have a fairly strong association. So when we go to, you know, a government agency or the Metro Council, we do have, you know, some clout and some weight behind us. but it's still a hard fight. You know, we had a development here where there's a historic property called the old ballet building and police station on Barzan Road, kind of right next to the Mid-City Mall. And some developers had come in, were planning to turn this into a brewery, you know, a microbrewery with a tour and a tasting room and some different things. Their plans fell through, and then they sold to another development group that wanted to turn this property into a storage facility. It's a commercial zone right now, C2, so there's a lot of things that they can do, but they wanted to turn it into a storage facility, and that needed a zoning change. And so our neighborhood association, we got together to fight this, and I ended up going, you know, literally door to door to people's houses, asking them to, you know, send a letter to the Board of Zoning, putting flyers on people's cars, asking them to come to the meeting. My thought and thought of the majority of people here was that a storage facility was a really bad fit for our neighborhood, and we did not want to see that historic property turned into a storage facility. And so we went to the Board of Zoning for the hearing, and it was the closest of close votes. It was a tie vote, and so in cases where there's a tie vote, the zoning stays with its existing zoning. And so, we literally squeaked by, but we had to mobilize the whole neighborhood in order to get that. And if we hadn't had a strong association, it wouldn't have been possible. But the other thing that I really wanted to do to the Metro Council was to make sure that every neighborhood in District 8, and then as many neighborhoods across the city, would have an official neighborhood plan with the city. And when a neighborhood gets an official plan, that guides development within that neighborhood. And it gives that neighborhood a strong voice and legal standing in terms of when something like that were to come in. And so we still would have had to fight that bad development, but our fight would have been easier if we have a neighborhood plan. And so, you know, so Tyler Park does not have a neighborhood plan right now. They are rather expensive. They're, you know, about $20,000 to get a neighborhood plan with the city. Some neighborhoods, Deer Park, they have one. Cherokee Triangle has one. But so, you know, I wanted to make sure that every neighborhood in District 8 had a plan with the city. That way, whether it's an Airbnb coming in or development coming in, whatever it may be, that way at least the neighbors have, you know, legal standing and have at least a fighting chance to stop what they view as a bad development in their neighborhood.
So if there's a development proposed for one neighborhood, that neighborhood association can band together with the other neighborhood associations in that district and apply pressure?
Yeah, so right now we have an agreement with the other neighborhood associations that if there's a bad development, we will write a letter in support of that other neighborhood association. But when you have a neighborhood plan, that's when you have more authority and you have more legal ground to stand on when there is something happening in the neighborhood that is deemed a bad development or something that is out of character for that neighborhood. But yeah, oftentimes Tyler Park will band together with other neighborhoods to voice our support for them in their fight against whatever it may be, whether it's an Airbnb or something else going on. I mean, there was a case the other day where Deer Park was fighting an Airbnb, and our neighborhood wrote a letter of support for Deer Park. And so that is definitely coordination and collaboration between the neighborhoods is important as well.
That's great. Are there any cross-district collaborations going on too with the neighborhood associations?
So that was actually the topic of our last board meeting for Tyler Park. Louisville used to have a sister city program with a town in France. They had an exchange program. And so there's a sister city program. And so the topic of our last neighborhood meeting was, you know, what if we take that program and replicate it on a much smaller scale and have a sister neighborhood program? So, you know, we could say, well, maybe there's a neighborhood, you know, I don't know, maybe in the South End or East End or West End, and reach out to other neighborhood associations and say, hey, let's establish a sister neighborhood program and learn from each other. Maybe we come to your neighborhood for one weekend, you guys come to our neighborhood for one weekend for a volunteer project. What are you guys doing that's really cool? You know, what are we doing? Kind of sharing information. So we are talking about a sister neighborhood program where it'd be sort of like an exchange program on a very, very, very local level.
You know, I had an idea years and years and years ago where one neighborhood would get together with a neighborhood like across town, another part of the city, mm-hmm. and they would go there and it would be based on the need for exercise, being outdoors and doing exercise. So you would have the people who wanted to do a walking tour in your neighborhood would go over to the other neighborhood, and representatives from that neighborhood would take you on a walking tour, point out various points of interest in their neighborhood. Uh-huh. And then you would cross back on the next week, and their neighborhood would come to your neighborhood, and it would be like
I love it. That is a great place to start. I mean, that's like just very basic, like, let's just learn about your part of town and you learn about our part of town. I love it.
Right. So you could do it all over town.
I'm going to steal your idea and incorporate that into our sister neighborhood program.
Oh, well, good. I'm so glad. It never falls on any fertile ground. I've mentioned it many, many times. So
no, absolutely. I love it. I think it's great.
Thank you. Well, I think we're about out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about? I've got several things that I've written down. The Giving Pantry.
Okay.
36 ways to help your neighbors. Donating to the Coalition for the Homeless. The U-Haul that's offering 30 days. I don't know if that's still true. 30 days of free self-storage. Oh, and the 100% renewable electricity by 2030. I thought the council passed a resolution on that, right?
Yeah.
That by 2030 that we would convert to 100%. And I'm thinking to myself, really? How can we do that?
That's the goal.
We're primarily on coal right now. Our electricity comes primarily from coal. What an ambitious goal.
Yeah, so that passed Metro Council like right before COVID-19 hit. So it kind of got overshadowed. But yeah, that's the goal. You have to start with identifying, you know, where the energy's usage is now. So getting, you know, things like smart meters on the different city-owned property is where you start with that. And then, you know, you start looking to, you know, where can you implement wind and solar? Well, you know, but you first have to, you know, kind of get maximum energy savings to reduce the energy consumption. And then once you reduce the energy consumption, then you start looking to add, you know, those alternatives, wind and solar. But yeah, it's an ambitious goal. I'm glad Louisville did it. Cincinnati did it before us. And so I think we've got, you know, a good model to follow with them and other, I mean, many other cities have done it. So it's not a unique thing to Louisville, but it could be really cool. And that was something that I wanted to work on, you know, if elected to Metro Council. So we'll see how that pans out.
Well, I think you're the right person in the right place with the right ideas right now, because.
Well, thank you.
And the reason I say this is we're not getting anywhere federally.
Yeah.
We're not having very good success statewide. Local is where it's at. The grassroots,
I think, is
the hope for getting us out of the mess that we're in right now. And it's a way of reestablishing our humanity with each other.
Right.
And I think that's at the grassroots of everything, you know, which is why we have grassroots radio.
Right. No, I love it. Yeah. So I am, you know, even though I lost the race for Metro Council, I'm still going to keep doing the work that I've always been doing. We've got all the work with Tyler Park going on that we're doing. We've got, you know, tree plantings coming up. We've got the work with Big Bars and Road Improvement Group that we're doing. And actually Big, we just got our nonprofit status for Big. And so we are now a community development corporation. And so Big is going to start applying for different federal and state grants that we'll begin to use to make some much needed improvements on Bars and Road. So yeah, so I'm not going anywhere. I'm still going to keep working the same way I always have.
Very good. I am so glad. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going on in District 8 and maybe having it overflow into some of the other districts, like my district,
right,
for example.
who's your councilman?
Bill Hollander. I'm District 9. Yeah.
Yep.
And we have, in my neighborhood, I think the last time I went to a neighborhood association meeting was maybe 7 or 8 years ago. We don't have them. So.
Yeah. So, you know, hopefully Councilwoman elect, you know, Armstrong, I'm hoping, you know, she'll adopt some of my ideas and proposals, but we'll see, but I'll keep fighting for them.
Very good. Well, it's been a pleasure meeting you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. That was Sean Riley, political activist and neighborhood and community organizer, speaking of his visions for his district, that is District 8, the Highlands, as well as his vision for Louisville. I interviewed him shortly after he lost his bid for District 8 Councilman in the June 23rd election. I hope that you've been inspired by some of the exciting grassroots-led initiatives that he mentioned on today's show. After all, who best to understand and remedy problems than those at the grassroots, those stakeholders, those neighbors, those parents, medical and social workers, garbage collectors, librarians, students, local business owners, even homeless, the incarcerated. However these folks are defined, they hold the key to community cohesion, resilience, and rebirth. So be thinking about prospects for your neighborhood. And while you're at it, consider donating to Grassroots Radio, where we at WFMP 106.5 FM put the U back into community radio. So go to www.forwardradio.org and click on the donate button. Well, that's it for today's show. Thank you for listening to
Election.